Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. A public visitation is scheduled for tonight and funeral services tomorrow for Frankie Freeman, the longtime civil rights advocate and attorney who passed away a week ago at the age of 101. Over her long life, her impact was significant in St. Louis and nationally. Joining me in studio to remember Mrs. Freeman are James Buford, former CEO and president of the Urban League of St. Louis. Adolphus Pruitt is president of the St. Louis NAACP. And Percy Green is a longtime civil rights activist here in St. Louis. Gentlemen, thank you so much for being
former
with us.
Former chairperson of Action.
Former chairperson of Action. Percy is always quick to remind me when I fail to mention that. Thank you, Percy, for doing so. Again, gents, thanks for being with us. Jim Buford, let me start with you. What's the first thing you think of when you think of Frankie Freeman?
I think of a holistic person. I was 15 years old, and my cousin wrote an article every week in the St. Louis Argus, and I was at her house, and Frankie Freeman was her friend, and Ina Boone. The two of them came over. And, you know, I was a little boy. My grandmother would tell me, like grandmothers tell their grandkids, you're going to be somebody someday. And I didn't quite know what that meant. And when I was 15, I thought that meant a basketball or football player or something like that. But when I set eyes on Frankie Freeman, she had an air about her. She had a carriage about her. I had never met anybody like that. And she was very nice and cordial, but I could tell right off the spot she was about business. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't take my eyes off her. And I said, I want to be like her someday. I didn't quite know what she did. And then when I got home, I asked my grandmother, what does she do? She said, well, she's a civil rights lawyer, and she does things that make people mad, but she's a very strong lady. And so I started reading a little bit about, and I followed her. So what I think about when I see Frankie is stature, courage, power, carriage, the way I would want my kids, anybody I know, to carry themselves as a leader in the African-American community. She was magnanimous. She was holistic.
And she was that way right up until the very last day of her life.
To the very end.
Adolphus Pruitt, what is your thought about Frankie Freeman?
You know, when you look at Frankie holistically, it is probably one of the few people who actually resemble their resume. Uh-huh. What you read and see about her and what you understand about her work and what she accomplished, it fits directly with her personality and the way she went about taking care of her business, especially when she was representing the NAACP. There's just no way to replace the type of work she did as attorney on behalf of our branch, especially when it comes to dealing with the issues of segregation and public housing and her impact on public education, especially the education of children here in the city of St. Louis. She fought in the courts to make sure that public education in St. Louis, especially for black children, was sufficient and was not a segregated system. And then to turn around decades later, and to be called back into service to assist with straightening out the public schools and to work with Dr. Danforth, I think it's just a testament that what they say, wine gets better, the older gets better with age.
Right.
I think it was a testament to that.
Right, Percy Green, your recollection.
Well, my recollection is she was certainly a personable person. My experience probably is not the same as these two giants there I'm sitting here with. But
don't sell yourself short, Percy.
But the thing about
it,
as a person, as I said before, she was personable. But we differed in terms of her politics. Yeah. I didn't particularly like her politics. And I had spoken out about that in the past and whatnot. But here was the thing. The two items that stand out, that really stands out for me, is that the McDonald's situation in 1959, she was a member of the Hesburgh U.S. Civil Rights Commission. Mm-hmm. And, of course, I kind of questioned as to how she was appointed. But the point is that when she was there, we had a hearing And I had to testify against the racial discriminatory practices at McDonnell Douglas.
This was your case that ultimately went to
this? No. This was just McDonnell Douglas practice prior to and up to 1959, I think, is when we had this hearing. And she was a counselor for the St. Louis she was a general counselor for the St. Louis Housing Authority at the time. And right after, during this testimony, and then, of course, I think she ruled in behalf of our testimony against McDonnell, she was terminated a month afterwards from the St. Louis Housing Authority. And I certainly, sympathize with her in that, being I've been a victim of such myself many times. But the mere fact that she stood her grounds. Of course, Father Hesburgh was here, too, I think, at the time. From Notre Dame, yes. And the both of them jointly supported our position against McDonnell Douglas and whatnot. So that was one. The other is that flowery, and that is the termination of Fire Chief Chief George. I always felt as if the former mayor Slay was a racist, and the mere fact that that incident of terminating Fire Chief George and also Charles Calls, both on the fire department, and cases of racial discrimination emerged. And it was obvious, and yet she supported Mayor Slay for mayor. That certainly was not. I often thought about that, and I didn't really understand that. But then I later, after analyzing it historically through the grassroots at the Gateway by Charles Lane, I was able to see some other things that occurred that may have had something to do with her decision making there.
Don, can I add something to that?
Of course.
To what Percy said. After that ruling and her siding, taking a stance against McDonnell Douglas, I get this from a good authority and people in power during my tenure at the Urban League. She was blacklisted.
Yeah.
She had extremely difficult time making a living and practicing law. She was punished for that. And even so, she held true to her convictions. Whether you agreed with them or not, she held true to them. But that startled me because I always thought, she's such an icon now and everyone sings her praises. But just like Dr. King, at the time, he's now a martyr and he is our true leader. We wouldn't be where we are today without Dr. King, but yet during his tenure and at the time he was assassinated, he wasn't very popular. The Black Power movement was taking over. And the same with Frankie. There's an ebb and flow in her life where when she took the hard ruling, she suffered for it. She could have been very wealthy. She could have been probably with a big law firm, one of the first. Or she could have been a judge at the federal level. Because she was a protege of Thurgood Marshall and Howard University. She studied under and worked with people at the NAACP Legal Defense Fund and a lot of the icons and stalwarts there. That's where she cut her teeth in D.C. at Howard. Because when she lived in New York, they wouldn't let her in law school, saying that her credits from Hampton University were not acceptable at law schools in New York. So it was when her and Shelby moved to D.C., she was able to get in law school, and that was at the Black University.
Yeah. How tough was she, Adolphus Pruitt?
She was soft-spoken and a lady, as Percy and Jim have said, but she had to be really tough.
Absolutely. Not only was she tough, but, the other day I was sitting down with Mikhail Ali, who's a Muslim and head of one of the activist groups, and we were talking. He said, man, I heard about Frankie. He said, Pruitt, let me tell you something. He says, I remember years ago, where the brothers were having an issue with one of their temples, and they had to sue the landlord. And he said they went to Black lawyers over and over again, and none of them represent them, said, we're not representing the Muslim. they went to Frankie, and he said Frankie took the case on and they won it. He said they were surprised and shocked that she would represent them when everybody else was telling them, no, we're not going to represent the black Muslims. She was just that type of person. She was just that tough. The issue was whether for her was right or wrong. And if she felt that it was right and it was the right thing to do, and she had that sort of conviction, and she did it. And she didn't care who was on the other side of the table.
That's right.
Well,
go ahead, Pastor.
Well, here was a something. Here is something else I noticed. Right after she come out of school, she took the case against the St. Louis Housing Authority, and she won the case. And then after winning the case, the St. Louis Housing Authority hired her as being the general counsel, as well as some other components of the St. Louis Housing Authority. Now, the thing about in 1957, we had an issue here in the city, and it was pretty much like we had in the past about changing the charter, wanting to reduce the size of the housing authority. I mean, the Board of Aldermen, yes. And then, of course, I mean, at that particular time, it was a big controversy, and then, of course, I decided that she was on. I would not have been on that side. I mean, she supported the change in reducing the size of the aldermen, and I would have been on the side, the opposite side. But, of course, I wasn't involved in the movement at that particular time. But just I'm just saying that it was something that I just scanned, just want to see the history of how people involved in the movement, people that have recognized, you know, the decisions that was made and so on and so forth, to try to find out, what, you know, why aren't those decisions consistent? I mean, I raised the same question with W.B. Du Bois and his decision-making, how, you know, up and down and so on and so forth. And so I just think that it's most important that certainly you want to give people they do, but you want to understand the decision-making, the good, the bad, and the ugly and whatnot. And when I pass on, I'm sure that you're going to find the same thing with myself. But I'm just saying that those were the things that was troubling to me in terms of some of those decisions.
And Percy, I'm going to eulogize you.
Who?
When you pass on, I'm going to do a eulogy.
Oh. I don't know if that's a warning or not.
Yeah, I don't know either.
Maybe you ought to get some idea of what he's going to say.
But, you know,
now.
None of us are perfect. You know, none of us perfect. But then it's something that about when folks are involved in the movement, it seems like to me that somehow when they become part of the establishment, they change, the energy level changes, or if they work behind the scenes, I mean, some say that, but very few of us that are on the front line ever see any evidence of working behind the scenes or whatnot. And so that's the thing that I'm saying, that there are differences in many folks that carried on the fight, initiated the fight, did a wonderful job. But then, of course, something changes. It could very well be as a result of the nature of their employment, or what had happened to her in 1959 being terminated for standing up for what was right. Maybe some of these folks, fear for their employment. I don't know whether that's justifiable.
It often comes down to economics, yeah. One way or another. I have to take a break. We've talked about her accomplishments and her personality, but before we take the break, let's listen to Frankie Freeman as she appeared on this program some time ago talking about what she thought was her greatest accomplishment.
Okay.
Well, I think I would probably, if I was going to identify one of the cases, it would be the case that ended segregation in public housing. However, I also am honored to have had the opportunity to serve as a commissioner of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, and also under the Carter administration as the first Inspector General of the Community Services Administration. But to say, I believe that probably the case that ended segregation in public housing.
The late Frankie Freeman, as she appeared on one of these programs some years ago. We'll continue our conversation, our recollections and remembrances of Frankie Freeman in just a moment. But first, we will take this break. My guests in studio are James Buford, Adolphus Pruitt, and Percy Green. Back in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. And welcome back. As we remember the late Frankie Freeman with Jim Buford, former CEO and president of the Urban League of St. Louis, Adolphus Pruitt, president of St. Louis NAACP, and Percy Green, who was former chairman of ACTION, the Action Committee to Improve Opportunities for Negroes.
Very good.
All right. We just heard Frankie Freeman before the break talking about her accomplishments as she saw them. And as a member of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission, I'm just wondering how much influence did that have on St. Louis, having a St. Louisan on that commission? Jim, that had to be helpful to this community, or was it?
Well, it had to be helpful. Otherwise, she would not have been terminated. The mere fact that she spoke out and supported the positions that we levied against McDonnell Douglas and Chrysler Auto Company was here at the time, and I had a group from there, the black employees of Chrysler, testified also. And so the mere fact that the Globe Democrat and the McDonald powers, as well as civic progress types and whatnot, levied against her, that caused her to lose her job. So she was certainly effective as it relates to that. But then at the same time, before that now, Jefferson Bank, that was in 63. Now, she did not support Jefferson Bank. As a matter of fact, I mean, when Lyndon Johnson came here and many of us was arrested out there at the park, I believe this was in 64, it was Lyndon Johnson, I think, at that particular time. She and he met at the Chase Park Plaza hotel at the time that we was picketing there and was arrested. And then, of course, after that was he appointed her to the U.S.
Commission on Civil Rights.
Yes.
Right. Jim,
when I said she was holistic, she impacted in so many areas. As Percy referenced earlier, the Davis versus St. Louis Housing Authority, that she referenced in her tape, was a big thing. Her impact on education, as Adolphus referenced, was, you know, when she was responsible, her and Dr. Danford, for setting up the special school board as well as monitoring. I served on that committee. The primary role initially was to monitor the desegregation settlement between the NAACP, the other 18, 19 litigants, and make sure that the judge's ruling was carried out to the letter. And that was our role as a committee. So we met monthly with various school districts and what have you, the plaintiffs in the case. And then that kind of morphed into a committee to take a look at the dysfunction among the board at the public schools, which led to be the special advisory board. So she impacted education. When I worked for – I came back to St. Louis in 81. I immediately went to Frankie and asked her to join my board. Well, I'm getting ahead of myself. In 1981, I was working for Governor Bond, running a program called Jobs for Missouri Graduates, but I also was being used as a liaison to the African-American community. I had been in Washington, D.C. for 5 years. I had been out of touch. And when I was here, I wasn't a leader per se. I was working in the private sector. So I called upon her to ask her if she would roll me out, if you will, to the black community, you know, the ministers, the other civil rights leaders like Reverend DeClue and those people involved in the NAACP, Bill Douthat. That's how I met Mr. Douthat, through Frankie Freeman. And if Frankie introduced the religious leaders, if Frankie introduced you, you had a high level of credibility already if she endorsed you. And then the only way you messed that up was personally you had to mess it up. So she laid the groundwork for me. And then when I took over the Urban League and was offered the job, I went to Frankie and I said, look, I'm going to take this job. But the condition is the Urban League has been, I felt, somewhat passive, doing the Jefferson Bank demonstrations, doing a lot of the civil rights things that were going on, the climbing of the arch, the did action, and what have you. I wanted the Urban League to be more advocacy-oriented. The Urban League's mantle was social services as well as civil rights, second oldest civil rights organization to the NAACP. And she said, of course, that's the only way you take it. And then when I took the job, I asked her to join my board because I had no really civil rights, and I had limited lawyers on my board, and most of them had nothing to do with civil rights. So during the entire tenure, my 28 and a half years at the Urban League, everything I did, shut down Highway 70, joining Johnny Scott and the NAACP in East St. Louis over no African-Americans being at any level in the Belleville government, the Million Man March, which the National Urban League opposed, which she encouraged me to do. Any comments I made on civil rights, I took her advice. Sometimes they were too tempered. She was conservative in that way. You know, her theory of civil rights was, you know, Thurgood Marshall and the NAACP League of Defense Fund solve the problems through law, and then they stay solved.
Yeah.
And that was her theory. So when I would get angry and upset about something, she would say, never get angry, get even. And not with a vendetta, but get even through the courts. Her impact on the urban, the entire – she was my first African-American woman to chair the board, the first woman to chair the board of the Urban League. And she stayed on emeritus because there is no tenure once you're the chairman of the board. Till the very end when she was, you know, until I stayed on, I would always call Frankie and ask for her opinion. Even if I didn't have an opinion and no one was asking me, in case they would, I would ask her, where are you on this? Mm-hmm. Like Percy. Sometimes I agreed. Sometimes I thought it was a little too soft. But Frankie Freeman guided me for 28 years. So her impact on the Urban League was phenomenal during my era and made us more in terms with the mission, civil rights and social service.
I would like to direct our audience to our website, stlpublicradio.org, for a wonderful conversation, one of the best I've ever heard, between Frankie Freeman and our friend Percy Green over here discussing the rule of law versus civil disobedience. Yeah, it's a wonderful conversation.
That's right, because, you see, I was on the other side. Disrupt,
exactly.
Disrupt. That's how you make things happen and whatnot, you know. And the thing about it is, of course, most lawyers, I mean, even though some of my best friends are lawyers, I mean, they were the people that kept me out of jail. And, of course, I had lawyers that had to argue the case of Green versus McDonald that made it possible to even prove racial discrimination, because at that particular time, Lewis Gildon was an associate of mine. He was the one that argued the case to the Supreme Court. And then Charlie Oldham, he argued the case the second time it went up to the Supreme Court. But the point I'm saying is this: we differed in philosophy as well, because, you see, if you depend upon the law in toto, you have to also think, be cognizant of, no sooner than you have a law passed in your favor, the opposite, the other side is looking for loopholes and ways to counter that.
It's a challenge.
And so, therefore, I could not get on board with that type of philosophy. And so that's why I had to continue to carry on civil disobedience and carry on the disruption in terms of letting those folks know on the other side that just because we had a law in our favor, we had to still pursue all kinds of inklings of racial discrimination.
One thing I want to say, Reverend Jesse Jackson has a phrase that I think defines the civil rights movement. There are tree shakers and there are jelly makers. Mm-hmm. The tree shakers shake the fruit off the tree. Someone comes along and picks up the fruit and turns it into jelly. That's the civil rights movement. There's Percy Green and the activists, and there are the Frankie Muse Freemans who come, and they're the jelly makers. Percy and them disrupt and knock the fruit off the tree and make change, and lawyers turn change into law.
But you need both of them to make the jelly.
You've got to have them. Right. There's nothing monolithic about the civil rights movement.
But let's remember just a couple of things, though, because when we talk about Frankie and we talk about the Civil Rights Commission, and actually, Percy, when Johnson came here to meet with her, it was because he called and he asked her to serve, and she first said no. And he came to convince her. He wanted her, and four presidents after him saw the same value and reappointed her. But the one thing that was unique, though.
Well, I'd like to respond to that also.
Yeah, but one thing that was unique, and I never forget, she talks about when the commission was meeting somewhere and they were supposed to go out and meet at a church and do something, and there was...
That was in Mississippi.
Yeah, and there was some stuff going on, and they burnt the church. Yeah, they said it was too dangerous, and she said they wouldn't want her to go. She got a call. She went anyway. Mm-hmm. That was just the type of person Frankie was. The other thing, more importantly, is that she had a quiet diplomacy also, that there are many, many, many instances where issues that were critical to the African-American community here in this city, and certain people had to be moved, and Frankie would make the call. Mm-hmm. She didn't make a bunch of noise about it. She didn't televise it, but she would make the call and say that, I think this is the right thing to do. This is what you need to do, and they would move.
Well, I certainly wish she had made that call to Slay in order to have Chief George remain as a fire chief.
Well, she made something to him.
But the thing about it is, I'm just saying that the decisions, I think basically these decisions, and I see too many times that this happened. See, there are all kinds of other issues that I think, let's say, for instance, the Board of Education. You see, not only I'm a strong supporter of civil disobedience and the kind, but I support organized labor, unions, the working class, you see? And so consequently, those are philosophical differences and whatnot, and I think that when you have people in a responsible position, you would like for them to speak out more in behalf of the working class. And if this is only reserved, when a person in a responsible position and they always speak out in behalf of the establishment rather than the people that are fighting for the causes, fighting for a cause. Like you take, for instance, with the Board of Education. I was on the opposite side of her position on that and Danforth. And I just think that the elected board was doing a decent job in as much as we changed the board by virtue of voting, and the mere fact that she supported Slay and the other side for this appointed board. I mean, the only place that happens is when you have predominantly black communities, that they would take the power from the elected board and put it in the hands of the white establishment.
Well, she also made an impact to education in her early days with Bruton versus the Board of Education.
Yes,
that was at a time when schools were segregated and all African-American school students went to Booker T. Washington Technical School, Washington Tech. The white students went to Hadley Tech. So obviously at Washington Tech, the curriculum wasn't as stringent and what have you. So there were some classes that were offered at Hadley that black students, there was a proposal for black students to go over to Hadley, and the public schools didn't want to do that. So she filed suit, Bruton versus the Board of Education, and won, and allowing the black students to go to Hadley to take these certain courses. Rather than bring the courses to Washington Tech, they had the students go there. And that worked for 1 year, and then after that, the public schools closed Hadley Tech.
Our time is beginning to wind down. I'd like to get an impression from each of you in the context of our discussion of Frankie Freeman. As to where, I'll start with you, Adolphus, where are we now in this whole struggle that we've been talking about that has so many different facets?
You know, unfortunately, with the last election, both in at the White House and in state government, there is an atmosphere in which folk openly trying to turn back the clock and remove some of the gains and the rights that African Americans have secured over the years. Fortunately, a lot of it is talk at this point in time. There's not much legislation that's been overturned. There's not much of anything that is happening, but it's on the horizon. And when we talk about folk having dual positions are changing. You know, my good friend Percy talked about labor, but it was labor who primarily flipped the script and came out and voted overwhelmingly in support of both Donald Trump and Governor Greitens. And those are the same folks who said that, hey, they care about civil rights and black folks. So sometimes people have to decide, you know, where they're going to be on the issue one way or the other.
Well, you have some sellouts in labor as well. So you have some
Uncle Toms. He had a bunch of them in his last election.
You have some Uncle Toms there in labor as well. I mean, I'm saying labor overall is a good thing. But I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was in Washington, D.C. for the inauguration of Barack Obama, and I was my grandson was born on that day, but I was in D.C. So I thought we had reached a pinnacle. Not, we still had a long way to go, but the election of a black man in the White House, all the work of the Frankie Freemans and those before her and during her time was seeing some fruit. I think now we're living in a Barack Obama backlash. I think, you know, we can blame Trump, but Trump was, it's the Trump that he ran. The way he ran, he didn't hold back. He make America white again. Well, he said make America great, but black folk knew and other folk knew, brown folk, yellow folk, that meant make it white, white again. So he isn't hiding anything. So I blame the body politic, which means I blame people. And I think a lot of people felt a black man in the White House was too much power, and they're gaining and they're taking our jobs. So I think where we are today, you know, I was on Martin Luther King's birthday 21 years ago. I was on KMOX radio with Reverend Joseph Lowry. He was in Atlanta talking about Dr. King. And Bob Hardy, may he rest in peace, asked Reverend Lowry, where are we at today in civil rights? And Reverend Lowry said, black folks are sick of racism and white folks are sick of black folks. Mm-hmm. I think we're getting to that now where black folks, just white folks just think black folks got too much power and brown folks and we don't want no immigrants. We don't want nobody but people from Norway. And Trump carries that mantle. So I think we're taking giant steps back. And all I can say is keep hope alive that maybe two steps back will make three steps forward.
Well, I would like to say I think we're at a place now where the leadership has to step up to the plate and be consistent. That, and I'm saying that about the politics now, you know, and especially I like what I see in Bruce Franks as being consistent. Just because he's elected to a so-called responsible position, that doesn't stop him from carrying on the struggle that he was carrying on. See, the point I'm making is that racism doesn't stop because you win a particular battle. The war is what you want to win, and that is has to be consistent. And with him maintaining civil disobedience, many of the other, it's enough racism that is going on a day-to-day basis that all of the black elected officials as well as fair-minded whites should be in the street protesting, raising hell or whatnot, you know, in order to neutralize racism.
Let's give Frankie Freeman the last word on that. We have a clip here in which she was asked the same question, and she remains optimistic up until close to the time that she passed away. Let's listen.
Well, I can't spend time being disappointed. I think what we all need to do is we all need to work for more diversity and recognize the value of each of us. And do something to help the people who need help. Do more. There are organizations who are working very hard. There are companies that are doing a lot. But still, individuals, we need to do more.
The late Frankie Freeman. There'd be visitation tonight at the Missouri History Museum. Funeral services tomorrow. Gentlemen, thanks so much for being with us. It's an interesting conversation and probably a difficult one for those of you who knew Frankie Freeman well, but I want to thank you. Theresa Green, great to see you. Jim Buford, always wonderful to see you as well. And Adolphus Pruitt, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.